speaker. Her name is Toni S. from Atlanta.
Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Toni. I'm an addict.
Hey,
Toni. Lordy Jesus. I'm going to just say that I would like to invite my God in. So can I have a moment of silence? And if you would like to invite your God in, please do. Thank you. Amen. Like again, I say, my name is Toni. I'm an addict.
Hey, Toni.
And I just want to thank the committee for asking me to come and share my experience, strength, and hope. And the topic is pain is inevitable and suffering is optional. And when Carol called me, you know, we talked about different other topics, but this one stood out for me. And I didn't know that at the time that she asked me to this time, and it was like probably last few days of January, maybe early February, but by the time that this shit came, the pain of life on life terms showed up so tough in my life. It's been the most difficult 90 days that I've had outside of my mother dying. Oh my God, I was like, oh, I'm getting some evidence to share this shit, right? Because I'm like, okay, what am I going to really share, you know? And I'm going to tell you, today I've been getting so full from all the workshops and all the things and all the stuff. And it's like information in my mind has been racing, but the information has been so deep for me because it's like now I'm in a place with this topic that I wasn't yesterday. You know what I'm saying? And I needed this information. That's why meeting makers make it. You cannot get the experience you get in a meeting that you can get in your spirit. You can't get it nowhere else. The sharing that happens in the meetings, you can't get it nowhere else. You know, using stops us from the sharing experience. It states in our literature. So when we come here, we don't know how to share. We don't know what to share. We were taught don't share, don't talk, don't cry, don't. You know, so when we get here, you don't know what to share, but the bullshit that you were sharing on the street, how to get one more, how to be slick and manipulate some shit. I remember, I'm going to tell you this. And see, I was the type of dope fiend. I come from the crack era, but alcohol was my drug of choice, but the crack chose me. Okay? But I was the type of dope fiend that would sit in the crack house and would sit my pretty ass still weighing 117 pounds and a one is too big and I could fit a 20 girl size thinking I look good, right? Sit my ass still wanting to hit the floor, wanting to look for the dope, wanting to beg and all that other shit. But everything inside me said, if I show them that inside, I can't get one more. Because see, I got the free dope. Okay? I ain't had no goddamn money to be paid for no dope. I didn't have nothing coming. You know how people be like, I lost. I ain't have shit to lose when I came here. Okay? So, I ain't have shit. I'm a girl from the hood. Born in New York. Lived in Chicago. In the projects. Went to Lorain, Ohio. Small town. And then Cleveland, Ohio. And that's where, I'm a city girl. So, I ain't no shit about having some things and owning some things. Because the shit will come and go. You know, sometimes I did rent-a-center. Sometimes I did, scheming however. However I could get some furniture through a church, through whatever, you know. And it's just, that was just the way my life was. My mother moved from city to city, state to state, neighborhood to neighborhood, and I did the same thing. So when I would be sitting in that chair, wanting to tell them, to just give me one more. So wanting them to know the obsession and the compulsion was on me so tough that I couldn't sit there, but I did. You're talking about facades. I could play the role. And I played it, but see, when I got around, it was like four people that I got high with. We was all on the damn floor, okay? We was on the floor together. We could do the crawling thing, smoking plant. From plaster to soap or to whatever. But when I was at the crack houses, I played the role. And I got the free dope. when the dealer would leave a room, I know that he knew how many rocks was there, so my ass would not steal from him just so I can keep getting dope. Because see, I was smart. I thought if I stole one, that will end it. I'm looking at my future. I'm looking at the investment of the thing, okay? So, I mean, that's how I did it. You know, that's, and at the end, I'm going to tell you my ways and means. Everybody's ways and means is different. Everybody's ways and means is different. Everybody's dope house is different. And y'all need to know what your dope house is. The bar is my dope house because alcohol is my drug of choice. Crack houses, believe me, is my dope house too. I ain't going to no crack house. I ain't doing no 12-step calling no crack house for no goddamn body. Ain't doing it. That ain't who I am. I'll meet you at a meeting, but I'm not meeting you at the crack house. I ain't picking you up. Catch a bus, go meet me at the damn hospital for detox or whatever you need to do. There's other courageous addicts in this room that do that shit. I ain't the one. Okay? Sorry. I've been here for 18 years. I'm going to keep doing what I do. I still go to meetings, I still pray, I still got a sponsor, I got sponsees, I do the literature, I work steps, I work traditions, and I don't know if I stop doing any of those things, what's gonna make me use, so I keep doing all the things that I do. And one of the things was not going to the crack house. Okay. But, I know that it's important for me, and I'm saying all this just for identification in the beginning, and I'll go into my story, it's just important to me to know what my limitations are. Okay, my limitations are I don't go out and go partying because my first drug of choice was fantasy and hanging out in clubs, and I loved it. I was 12, 14, hanging out, watching people jiggle glasses of alcohol and saying, one day I'm going to do that because that shit looked cool. That was it. And one day I did, and now I'm here, okay? So I'm not confused about what my dope house is, okay? So I don't do that. Some people can. You know, just like some people can't take medication, I can. Because pills wasn't my thing. And I'm grateful for that. But if somebody told me I had to take a hit of crack or drink some alcohol in order to get rid of a illness, I would have a problem. And that's the only identification I come up with when people got to do Percocets and that was their drug of choice. Because I know it would be difficult for me to drink some damn 151 to get rid of a cold or something, you know. Y'all won't see me no more. But I'll be like, Anthony P, he said, come and get me. Please come and get my ass, because I'm the type, I always said, if I go out, I lost my goddamn mind. But please come and get me, because I'm an addict. I'm not invincible. That's why I do it one day at a time. That's why I keep coming back. That's why I stay here while I'm here. Because I know that that's a possibility for me too. I'm not exempt from using. Okay, it was a couple of weeks ago. I'm going to tell you, I walked out of an interview and I wanted to die. Suicide for me is not a real subtle, like, just go kill yourself, Tony, shit. Okay, it comes in the way that, you know, my sponsor had to make me know that I can be suicidal. Since I've been in recovery, I've had two suicidal thoughts. My first one was when I had 12 years clean and I said to myself, I don't want to wake up. Okay, I didn't think really much of it, but when I told my sponsor, she thought that was some serious shit. That means that you don't want to wake up, that means you want to die. I'm like, okay. Hell, I didn't think about it like that, but I thought about it like that. The second one was maybe about 2 weeks ago. And I said to myself after I came out of that interview and feeling so humiliated. Because, see, got 18 years in my mind, I should have a fucking degree. I should be further along in my life. I'm 47 years old. I shouldn't be living in my daughter's house not having a place to lay my head. Gotta lay my head wherever a body ain't. Okay? I shouldn't be not having a job at 47 years old with no goddamn retirement of nothing coming into my life. And because I was living paycheck to paycheck when I got fired from my job, I have nothing financially to back me. Okay? So when I came out of that interview, and I don't even want to talk about the man thing, okay? Because he, 2 weeks after I lost the job, he said, "I think we need to go our separate ways." And I was living with them, which made me homeless. So, when I was coming out of that interview, and that white woman, and it ain't no respect, I got Irish in me, okay. And that white woman sat across from me, and see, the white people down in Atlanta, it's a little bit different than the ones that I grew up with in the North. You know what I'm saying? It's just their little attitude, like, you ain't shit. And the way that she talked to me and said to me, younger too, of course, I can pay you $8.40 an hour. Last job I had was making 15, because I'm a certified counselor. And I told her, I said, you know, I'm in transition. You know, we figure out how to say nice things here. We know how to put together some words. Like I said, we come from not sharing. I know how to share some shit, right? So I said, I'm in the middle of a transition right now, and I'm looking for an apartment, and I doubt if I can take care of myself on $8.40 an hour. So I'm going to pass on that. But if you can come up with any more, and it was a security position, doing security, please give me a call. That was humbling for me not to take that, okay? And to have some integrity to say I'm worth more. Because, see, I'm Miss Settle, you know, and I'll settle for some shit. But I ain't settling today. I am not settling today on no area of my life. I'm not settling today. So I walked out of there, and I got to my car. And I said to myself, why am I doing this? There's no point to even go on. I don't even want to continue on. That was the suicidal thought. And then after that, my disease kicked in. And it said, then I said to myself, I might as well just go use. And then recovery kicked in. It's like having this conversation with some all kind of shit going on in my head, like three people, right? And I was like, that's some really dumbass shit. Okay. I started to cry. I got in my car, said I can't drive and cry at the same time, took my ass home. You know, and I was into that, but I didn't share with anybody. And I shared it with another recovering addict, and he told me that I need to share it at a meeting, and I need to open up, and I need to share what's going on with me. And I didn't want to. And so I did my first Burning Desire in Atlanta. They have this time where you can share if you want to use, and I shared. And it was 4 days later, but I shared because the thought of using did not go away. It stayed with me that week. Thank God for a difference of what a day makes, because each day is different. You never feel the same way in 2 days. You know, every day I wake up, I don't know what's in store for me and how I'm going to feel, but I know what I'm going to do. And one is pray and ask for guidance and ask God to take care of me and to watch out for me and to be there for me, because I'm going to tell you, that's who's been carrying me through this. You know, So, I want to talk about some pain, even though I know that was some pain, but I want to talk about some pain. You know, one thing is, when I was 3 years old, was the first time, and I haven't really shared this at the podium too much. I don't think I ever shared it. I shared it once. But I always use my stepfather as the catalyst to my pain, and especially the sexual abuse, and it didn't start there. You know, it started when I was 3 years old, and I remember looking at some woman's private area, and I thought to myself, because it was the middle of the night, and I woke up in bed with this white woman, and she was kind of large, and she had blonde hair but had red hair in her pubic area. And I was three, and I remember saying something was wrong with that. Why she got red hair and is blonde, and you know. And then I remember at three, kids lifting up my clothes. But I didn't think of anything about it. And then I remember at six, when my stepfather came into my life and he set me on his lap, and he said that my underwear were dirty. And from that point until I was 11, he molested me. And I remember from 12 to 14, after he stopped, my sister's husbands, they were boyfriends at the time, molested me. So I was really, when it came to sex, really messed up. You know, that pain is something as a child I couldn't avoid. That's what inevitable means to me. I couldn't avoid it. It was something that could not escape my life because as a child, you don't pick the family you're put in. You got to deal with the hand that you are dealt with. And that's what I was dealt with, you know. And I always just focused on my stepfather because he was in my life up until my mother died, which was September 3rd of 2005, okay, from 6 until then. And I used to always say, the only way that he'll be out of my life is if my mother will leave him. But I'm going to tell you this today. I wish, the only way that he really came out of my life, my mother dying. And I'd rather that he just stayed in my life and she be here. Because guess what? I dealt with the shit anyway. All them years, he was still there. I still had to tolerate him. Still had to deal with him regardless because he was in my mother's life. Okay? So it was like that pain I could not avoid. But the suffering that came behind that is probably, no, ain't no probably, I know still affects me today to some degree in relationships. Okay, the suffering that I'm finding out is based on hiding, based on pretending, the fantasy thing I told you about, based on procrastination, based on settling. See, I thought that because I didn't have any control in my life, that I probably will not be able to get what I really deserved or earned because I had to deal with what was brought to me. So when it came to relationships and men, I settled. You know, I said some hurtful things to the brother that I just broke up with, which he's still holding me hostage to. And it's like somebody had said to him while we were doing a three-way thing, because we've been having some major, like, conversations, there's more people involved in my fucking breakup than it was in us getting together, okay? It's like, would y'all just fucking go away, you know? But the lady who is my spiritual advisor said to me, why do you settle? If he's not what you want and desire in life and attracted to and need, why do you settle? I was like, hell, I ain't never been attracted to nobody I've been with. I've always settled. I mean, what do it matter? I mean, the attraction? Shit. What do that mean? You know, but what it made me see is that, what the hell am I really doing? She said, well, maybe you need to look at what you're doing. Maybe you need to look at your choices that you make. And I had to figure out, what the hell am I doing? For real. Because, see, it's about, I can get better in here. But I'm getting better with what I do that's automatic and unconscious. I can get better with the lies of telling myself that it's all right. As long as the person is meeting some needs and I'm meeting some needs and we get along. Because see, what that last relationship did for me was there was no confusion and no arguments. I grew up in domestic violence, y'all. From 6, that same damn man used to beat the shit out of my mother from head to toe. She had bruises all over her body, would fight my family. And then from the time I was 15 until I came into this program, I went through domestic violence to where I became a perpetrator. You looked at me, I jumped on your ass. I don't care how big you were, I'd be picking up stuff. I was the type of woman that would pick up stuff. My hands too small to be hitting anybody. So I was hiding knives and hitting you with globes and, I mean, faces and frying pans and whatever the hell I could pick up. Okay, it was a part of your body. If I thought you were going to hit me, not if you hit me, but by thinking, don't intimidate me because your ass is mine. And that's and I was like that big, you know. Little women, you know, it tries to be scary, you know. But all I'm saying is that the suffering that came behind that whole sexual abuse for me still affects me today. You know, I'm going to tell you this. This is crazy. And I may share some crazy shit, but I think about 8 months before my mother died, my stepfather was in the hospital and he was refusing to have triple bypass surgery done. And my sister said, go see him. And then my boyfriend said, you need to put closure on that. So I thought, okay, I need to go and tell him I forgive him. So I did. While I'm walking down the hall, I'm thinking, should I take my jacket off? Should I have it on? He's going to look at my butt. What is going to happen? You know, tripping. And I get there and I share it and I sat there for an hour with him. And I said, I ain't touching him. So I share with him, I forgive you. And he looked at me and he was like, you forgive me? I said, for everything. We ain't had to discuss what? We ain't had to go into details. While I was leaving, when I was about to leave, he said, well, have a nice life. I said, you too. He said, well, if I ever see you again, I said. And he started crying. And I went and embraced him. And I told him it was going to be all right. And I told him to have the surgery. He did. He lived. I mean, I'm better because I used to say, when he had a heart attack once, I was like, I just want to punch him in his fucking chest. You know? So I came, you know? And a few years before that, he wouldn't let me talk to my mother on the phone. I'm on my way to the Highland Club. That's a club in Atlanta. And I was telling him on the phone, I will kill you. He was there in Chicago, right? And I'm screaming at the top of my lungs, driving down the street because he wouldn't let me talk to my mother on the phone. He kept hanging up. I was like, listen, I will kill your ass. Okay, so I had came a long way with that. So it was like, on my mother's birthday, about 2 weeks before my mother's birthday, which was August 14th of 2005, and that was 2 weeks before she died, I used to drive up and down the highway to go see my mother in the last 10 months of her life from Atlanta to Cleveland, Ohio, once a month or at least twice, sometimes two times a month. I was finally stepping up to the plate to be the daughter that I could be. It took me all that time in recovery. I couldn't do it before then. You know, I couldn't even forgive her before then. But I'm glad that I was able to, for whatever reason. But my sisters and everybody in my family know I'm the crazy one. I'll cuss you out, I may hit you, anything, you know, so they know how I am. So I had a headache. I went into the room, and my sister came in there and was like, Callum came to visit. I said, I seen that. That's why I closed both the doors. I don't want to see him. She was like, I was hoping you would come out so he won't stay so long. I'm like, okay. I went out because some reason my mind was telling me I need to get my purse out the room with my mother. I don't know why. I went in there and he started that bullshit. I'm talking about my ex. Not the boyfriend, but the ex. How you and Steve doing? You know we ain't together. You know that. Oh, I didn't know that. And then I was like, look, I ain't doing the dance. I ain't doing it today. I'm not doing the dance today. And I let him know that he wreaked havoc in my family's life and that we fucking was crazy behind the things that he has done. And my mother heard that. And she told him after I left the room because they came and got me. She told him, don't come back here with that. Don't you ever talk to my daughter like that again and don't you upset her. He never came back and I don't think he's seen her again alive. And I'm saying this to say this is the crazy hit on this all. My sister called me about a month ago and said, I want to share something with you. And I know, be me smiling, and after what I tell y'all, y'all gonna be like, this woman is sick. And I am. She was like, Callum got his balls cut off. I was like, what? She said, he got an infection and they cut his balls off. My first reaction, I screamed. And then after that, I laughed. And then after that, I cried. And I also pray for him that he recover. Because I got to do the right thing, right? And he did. My sister got a sense of humor. She also called me about a few days ago and said, "Calvin, come to live with you down in Atlanta." I said, "Oh, no. Hell no. I ain't taking care of his ass. Oh, no, no. Because nobody won't take care of him. So he got to go in a nursing home. See, you reap what you sow. You know. And the thing is that I never thought, I guess the joy was, I never thought in this lifetime, because there ain't no whooping like the one that God give you. And I didn't think, when I was 16 years old, I had to, because he swung on me. He told his daughter that I was a streetwalker, I'm a bitch, and I'm a whore, and this is the kind of thing we would go through after, since the molestation stopped. And I told him, "No, you the streetwalker, you're the bitch, and you're the whore." And so we started fighting. Of course, I went for the knives. Even though I didn't even know where the woman's knives was, but I found them. And she set me down and told me to open this book, and I opened and I pointed to a page, and it said, "Vengeance is mine, said the Lord." So from that point to that point of when my sister shared that with me, I thought in this lifetime I would not see any retribution that would come from him for what he has done to my family and countless others, because I know I was not the only one. But I don't wish any bad on anybody. You know what I'm saying? But I'm going to tell you one thing about our children. We need to protect them by any means necessary. Boys and girls. Boys are not exempt from that. The things that I had to experience and to grow up in, I don't wish on nobody. You know, and I'm grateful that I never was penetrated. Okay, because I don't even know how deep that is for me, because I know other people have been there. You know what I'm saying? I just know my experience and how fucked up that has made me. I had to go to counseling. You understand? Outside of this, I got some additional help for that to grow me up so that I don't have to make a list of what you need to do to me sexually so I won't be reminded of being molested. And I know there's some people in here who can identify with that. You know, so that suffering piece, it's some suffering that can go on in your life today. For me, it's like that I wouldn't even know that it's happening because it's so automatic and unconscious. You know, because I go into this mode because it's part of the stuff that I happened, like the domestic violence that happened from 6 until I was 28, okay? And from that, thinking violence was okay. Not saying that if you hit me, you love me shit. No. It's saying that we got to get down. That's part of life, and I'm going to fight. Okay? So it's like, I want to read one thing out of the basic text. We experience failure. We learn to how to succeed. Often, we have to face some type of crisis during our recovery, such as death of loved ones, financial difficulties, or divorce. There are realities of life. These are realities of life, and they don't go away just because we get clean. Some of us, even after years of recovery, find ourselves jobless, homeless, and penniless. We entertain the thought that staying clean was not paying off. And the old thinking stirs up self-pity, resentment, and anger. No matter how painful life tragedies can be for us, one thing is clear, we must not use no matter what. The thing is, for me, is that my suffering goes on up here. Okay, it's not about life situations. December 31st, I prayed and asked God to order my steps. I also asked him to, I told him that I would be obedient to whatever he does to follow it through. This January 16th, my job forced me to resign. 2 weeks later, the man left. My children have lost their damn mind. And the situation that I'm in today may seem hopeless, but it's not. Because I have a sense of freedom that I've never had. I feel like an 18-year-old starting all over again. But the thing is that My suffering can be people pleasing, caretaking, pretending, not telling the truth about what's really going on with me. Yes, I'm in love with my best friend and it can't happen yet. You know, stuff like that. Right now, I don't need a relationship with nobody. Okay? I got to get a relationship with myself. I've established a relationship with God. I have. Through these 18 years, me and God is like on one-on-one right here. He ain't in the sky. He right in there with me. He everywhere I go. He's in everything I touch. Okay? And I love God. I love the relationship that I have with Him. My foundation is a spiritual one. I pray to Him all the time, constantly. Okay? So that, even when I don't feel, see, feelings aren't facts. Just because you feel it doesn't make it so. Even if I don't feel spiritual, I know I'm spiritual because the spirit that dwells inside of me is God. I'm connected. And no matter what, there's no disconnection. But I can't turn my back on that source of power. And I'm working real hard on not to do that today. So my suffering that's optional is all in my head. So what I do is I do the opposite. And I stay in touch with my sponsor. And I stay in touch with my support group. And I, believe it or not, I'm going to share this and then I'm going to pass because my time is up. Is I've been limiting where I go, because I'm going to tell you, backbiting and gossip is not the thing to do, especially when somebody's hurting. I can't do gossip about me. I told you who I am. Okay? I ain't hit nobody in 3 years. The last person I hit, I grabbed by the throat, threw him up against the wall, and it was my daughter, and I feel bad, and I made amends, and my amends has changed the behavior. So I ain't hit nobody in 3 years, but within 10 seconds, I had smacked her, mugged her, and pushed her up against the wall. Okay? I don't want to be like that. But gossip and backbiting makes me not want to share, makes me not want to come into certain meetings, makes me not want to come around. And I ain't never not wanted to come around before. You know? So it's real important that we show love when people are hurting. That we as a fellowship step up to the plate and carry that person. Call somebody. I'm a fucking isolator. I need people to call me. And I tell people in my network, call me. And if your ass is like saying, well, you don't call me, then don't fucking call me. But let me tell y'all something. The people that you think gonna support you ain't gonna support you. The people that will support you is the ones that God will send you. I may be going through a difficult time, but I ain't lost my hope. I know where my source of strength lies, and this is with the God of my understanding. And my sponsor, she's been in my life since 94, and I love her dearly, and I'm grateful for her. You know, and I just gotta keep coming back. I gotta stay here while I'm here. I'm going to read something in closing. It says, we grow through pain and recovery and often find that such a crisis is a gift, an opportunity to experience growth by living clean. Before recovery, we were unable to conceive of the thought that the problem brought gifts. This gift may be finding strength within ourselves or regaining the feeling of self-respect that we had lost. I know that what I'm experiencing is not just for me. I know that it is also for me to share my experience, strength, and hope so somebody else can know that you too can go through this without using no dope. Just for today, we ain't got to use. And if I didn't help anybody, please listen to your own story, because that's the one that got you here. That's the one that will keep you here, and that's the one that's going to keep you clean. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Our second speaker is not only my friend, but my sponsor, and her name is Denise.
Hi. Hi, my name is Denise, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Denise.
And I have to just thank God for allowing me to be here, because only by His grace and His mercy am I able to do that. You know, I want to thank Rakaya, for Carol, for calling me to ask me to come to Baltimore, because I'm from Miami. And it's only by His grace that I'm here, because I really didn't want to come, because I had so many other things to do. And what I've learned is that because of Narcotics Anonymous, I'm able to be here. Now, I don't know if I'm going to make you laugh. I don't know if I'm going to make you cry. I don't know if I'm going to make you sigh. But what I'm going to do is talk to you about what the topic is about. And the topic is pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. You know, I'm an addict. My whole life was centered around getting and using and finding other ways and means to get more. I was a woman whose whole life was controlled by drugs. And I don't know if you know what it means to be controlled by drugs, and I'm an educated person. I came here with degrees, but because my disease was much more powerful, was much more favorable, was much more desirable than what I wanted to do in my life, I ended up pushing buggies and picking up bottles and cans out of people's yards. And I have a degree. I was educated. I don't have any stories about sexual abuse. I don't have any stories about not having two parents. The story that I have is that I'm a person whose life was controlled by drugs. I started at 15 and I was a pill head because it was prescribed, and I learned real early how to create pain in my mind, because today that's where a lot of it comes from. I did Percocets, Darvons, Darvocets, and when I got real sick, I went to the hospital so they could shoot me up with Demerol and Vistarol, because I'm an educated addict. And I could convince the doctors that the pain I was feeling was real. And some of us are still convincing people that the pain we feel is real. I continued to use drugs. By the time I finished high school, I was valedictorian. But when I went to college, my drug addiction took off. I was very private because I was educated. I didn't want people to know not only what I was doing, but what I was thinking, because my thinking was sick. I graduated from college, top 5% in my class, and my life began to do some things that I thought it would never do. I began to hang out with drug dealers. At first, because I was educated, I used drugs privately. I only snorted cocaine. And I began to see all the big and pretty things in life, you know, all the fancy cars. And somewhere, with the perfection in my life that I had created in my mind, I was supposed to get married and have a baby, not have a baby and then get married. So what I did, I got pregnant and I moved away, because people couldn't know about me because I had an image. I was educated. And they needed to know that. And my life began to do things that I thought it would never do. And I started freebasing. in 1979, but don't forget, I was educated. I was working for the school system, but I couldn't hardly go to work. I would leave my daughter downstairs in the daycare because I would be upstairs sleeping because I had been up all night freebasing. But remember, I'm educated. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional, and I didn't know how to tell somebody that I was a using addict. People knew something was wrong with me, but because I had connections, they couldn't get rid of me. And I kept using day in and day out. I tried to stop, but I couldn't stop. I wanted to stop. I needed to stop, but I didn't know how to do it. And eventually, see, I can't tell you my whole story, but what I want you to know is that the pain that I felt during my addiction was created by the things that were going on in the world, and the suffering that I felt was created by me. I didn't have to suffer. I chose to suffer. Although I wanted to stop, I couldn't. I didn't know how to. Eventually, I lost my daughter. Eventually, I lost everything that I had. And then one day, they told me that I could no longer work for the school system. And that was fine with me because by then, I had gone on a 3-year run. I went into treatment. I heard what the people were saying, but I really wasn't paying attention to what the people were saying. They were talking about how, well, if you just go to meetings, if you just get a sponsor, if you just work steps. I went into the program with the idea of stopping, but I went for the wrong reason, because what I basically wanted to do was to keep my job, and eventually I lost that. And as time progressed, my disease progressed. I remember living in base houses, waking up in the morning only to find my body fluids doing whatever they were doing because I didn't know who had been with me. And remember, I'm educated. But my disease had taken me so far down that the pain and the feelings that I felt on the inside, nobody could help me with it but myself, because I had made a decision to do what I was doing. And it just kept on. I went into 3 treatment facilities, and in the year of 1989, I made a conscious decision. Because if you know like I know, I was unconscious. I became conscious once I came into Narcotics Anonymous, and not until I made a conscious decision that I was going to stop using was I able to stop. And it's not easy being clean. It's not easy staying clean. You have to be a very courageous person. You have to be a person who wants to persevere no matter what. And that was what I had to realize once I made the conscious decision to come into Narcotics Anonymous and stay. And some days it isn't easy. I can't say that there's a lot of great things that are painful in my life. I mean, everything is doing what it needs to be doing. I will tell you that when dealing with pain, I find that once I admitted that I had an addiction, once I realized that my life was unmanageable, I could somehow have some type of hope in my life. You know, the hope that I needed to have was the hope that no matter what I did, I could stay clean. In spite of everything that has happened to me, in spite of everything that has gone on in my life, I realize that I get a chance to stay clean, but I have to be open to change. I have to have an open mind. I have to be able to listen, you know, to what people say to me, listen to what people suggest to me, believe what people suggest to me, and just feel like, well, whatever is going on in my life, then that's what I need to be doing. It's about working the steps. You know, I can't see any way in avoiding or not feeling pain and not having to suffer, because once I apply the steps and I internalize the principles in my life, some good things are going to happen for me. You know, pain is inevitable and suffering is optional. You know, and they talk about, you know, well, let's talk about what's going on with us. And basically for me, my greatest area are relationships. Relationships with people. Relationships with people on my job. Relationship with people in my life, whether it's platonic or whether it's sexual. And I hope when I talk about me that you all will still like me. Because for many years in my life, you know, I grew up in a family where it was okay for people to cheat. It was okay for me to be dishonest in relationships because that's the way I was brought up. And after being in Narcotics Anonymous and getting into relationships with people who did not belong to me, pain was inevitable, but suffering was optional. A lot of it I bought on myself because if you needed me, you wouldn't leave me. So I tried to figure out what I could do for you. You know, what could I buy you? What could I get you? Where could I take you? And the more I gave, the more pain I felt. Because no matter what I did, they didn't like me anymore. They didn't draw to me anymore. And I had to realize that, you know, pain is inevitable. Suffering was optional. And I continued to do the same things over and over again when I was looking for hope, when what I actually needed to do was I needed to surrender. I needed to just let it go. I needed to just let go, but I didn't know how to do that. I would go to meetings, I would raise my hand, I would share, I would do what was suggested for me to do, but for whatever reason, it didn't work out like it was supposed to. And my disease could to continue, because I don't know about you, but my disease lives in my mind. I basically know what I'm going to do before I even make a decision to do it. I know what I'm going to say. I know how I'm going to act. I know how I'm going to react because I've already thought about it in my mind. It tells us in the second step that I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And in order for me to do that, I had to realize that the unnatural process, which were the things that I did when I was using, had to now become a natural process. And I had to understand that as long as I internalized the principles. See, I don't know about you, but, you know, working the steps and practicing the steps are two different things. Working the steps and practicing the steps are two different things. And what I have to basically do is to also internalize the principles. And once I gained some hope about doing what I needed to do and accepting the fact that my addiction and my thinking is basically what put me in the positions that I was in, was I able to do something about what was really going on in my life. The program of Narcotics Anonymous has helped me to understand that I can do anything that I want to do. I can go any place that I want to go. You know, even in the process of me losing my job, even in the process of me losing my children, I have gained most of those things back. You know, I got my job back. I got my kids back. I have both of my kids living at home. But, you know, recently and lately, there was like this demonic spirit that was living in my house. It was like people were living there that who did not need to be there. And it was causing problems, not only in the relationship with me and my daughter, but it was causing problems in my relationships with my job because I was trying to pay attention to what was going on in my home when I really didn't have a lot of control of it because I made decisions about letting people live in my house that I shouldn't have had living there. And had I not raised my hand to even share it in the meetings as to what was really going on with me, I wasn't able to deal with it because I had to understand in order for me to free myself, I had to tell somebody what was going on with me. A lot of different things have happened that has caused different pain in my life. There are tragedies that have happened, different situations that have happened. My brother was killed. We went to Tallahassee to attend something called the Affirmative Action, and you know, our goodness and our ways of doing things, we decided that we would stop and help people. And in the process of saving two people, a truckload of plywood fell on top of my brother. And for years, I blamed myself because I begged him to go. And what I basically had to do was get outside help. You know, I couldn't just go on in my life believing and thinking that because of a decision that I had made, that it was my fault. You know, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. I mean, there were some days that I couldn't go to work because of what I felt like I had done. And then there were other areas in my life where there were different tragedies. And what I had to understand was that I don't have any control. The only control that I have is responding to what I need to do and not reacting to it. And for many, many years, you know, I wanted to suffer and feel bad on the inside about the things that had happened in my life. There have been many, many incidences where I didn't really know what I needed to do, because the process of recovery, just like the process of my disease, kept me in places where I didn't want to be. And because I didn't want to be there, I didn't know what to do about it. So I would raise my hand and I would share, you know, the things that I was feeling, and the things that I was feeling was the things that I needed to share. And things began to get better for me. You know, I believe in God, I pray to God, I have sponsors, I have a sponsor, I have sponsees, and I do a lot of service in Narcotics Anonymous. And the reason that I do service is because that's my give back. That's my give back for being able to stay clean. And being able to stay clean sometimes, as I said, it's not easy. But I stay. I stay centered and I stay focused. You know, for many years, you know, I thought that people that came into Narcotics Anonymous didn't really stay clean. You know, I can remember going to detox and my dad would just cry. He would cry all the time saying that, you know, I just needed to stay clean. You just need to stay clean. And I remember, you know, riding in the car with him, having him to, you know, say to me, you know, you just need to get yourself together. And it wasn't easy because it really wasn't something that I wanted to do. It was something that I needed to do. And when I made a decision that I wanted to stay clean, that was when I was able to do that. And I just basically stay focused. You know, I go to meetings, I work steps, and I internalize principles. And I just want to say thank you for letting me share.